History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
We're poor, we're poor. Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York, Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Ray,
John Henry Clark, John
Dr.
Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe. Hotep, and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We do truly thank Dr. Julian Carr from Howard University for those profound libations that were spoken. I hope your day has been a productive and relaxing day. It's a very sunny day here in Lithonia, Georgia, temperature about 62 degrees. The Black Reality Think Tank is broadcast live here through the internet platform of timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com. Our studios are here in Lithonia, Georgia, and we broadcast live every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Our program is sponsored by the Motherland Media Network and is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. We sincerely thank you, our listening audience, for your patronage and your continuing support of our program activities. We have a very, very dynamic conversation this evening. We're going to introduce our guests just very shortly. But let me just add also that the Black Reality Think Tank is an information sharing and discussion-oriented program. It is designed to understand the past, dissect the present, and support implementing a meaningful future. The purpose of the Black Reality Think Tank is primarily historical research designed to teach and to inform and to empower African-American community leaders. Through our radio program and social media, we present well-researched facts and evidential proof that will assist the community in constructing meaningful agendas and setting realistic program goals and objectives. We do believe here at the Black Reality Think Tank that all of history is a current event. All of history is a current event. And we promote that idea. And we also promote the idea that you will never know where you're going unless you understand from whence you came. Our program here is a call-in format. We are going to have a dynamic discussion with a very brilliant and award-winning filmmaker who has produced a wonderful documentary that we're going to talk about. If you so desire to call and ask a question or just simply to join the conversation and make a comment, the number is area code 215-490-9832. And I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. And you can, at that point, ask any questions or make any comments that you have for our program. We already have some folk on now who are members of our panel, and so who are normally here all the time. So anyway, we are looking forward very clearly to continue to talk with them and also to talk with our very special guest who is calling, who is actually from Jamaica. But as you know, always, I'd like to give honor to our ancestors. And very quickly, I'm not going to go into a long description, not because this ancestor is not important, but we want to give plenty of time to our guests. And so I am going to just briefly mention one of our great ancestors, whose name is Jean-Jacques Dessalines. Jean-Jacques Dessalines. He was born September 17th in 1758, and he died based on an assassination in October 1806. He was a leader of the Haitian Revolution, and he was the first ruler of an independent Haiti under the 1805 Constitution. Initially regarded as the Governor General, Dessalines was later named Emperor Jacques I of Haiti from 1804 to 1806 by the generals of the Haitian Revolution. He is regarded as one of the founding fathers of Haiti. And I will hold there so that we can go right into our dialogue. I have with me, and I had just spoken with her earlier, and first of all, started off by apologizing because I'm going to have a little difficulty in pronouncing her last name, but she has given me permission to use her first name. But she is a dynamic filmmaker. She lives in the country of Jamaica, and she has produced a wonderful documentary that, as I said, we're going to talk about it, and it's called The Price of Memory, The Price of Memory. And it deals with a long-term reparations struggle by the Rastafarians of Jamaica, and it speaks to a specific incident that occurred in 2002, and she is going to discuss that. I'm going to let her get into that part of it, into that discussion. But it's also an ongoing struggle that still continues today, and eventually it led to a court case, a lawsuit that against the Queen of England. And then, but the movement still continues, and I want her to talk a little bit about that movement in which her film addresses some of the merits of the court case and things that we can need to understand a little bit more about the reparations court case and what is it that we might need to do as we continue the fight for reparations. And also just a little history of the slave trade in Jamaica. She's, in order to fight for reparations, you have to have a very clear understanding of the background of it. You have to be able to talk about reparations and what it is and the whole concept legally and ethically of the idea of repair and how that is done in an economic form. So with that, I am so proud and happy to introduce my guest. As I said, she is from Jamaica, the country of Jamaica. She is, and she has done several films, and she can talk about some of the other ones that she's done. She has some that's coming up. But the one that mainly we're here to focus on tonight is The Price of Memory. And her name is Karen Marx Mafondikwa. Mafondikwa. And again, I'm going to ask her to apologize again and give us maybe the correct pronunciation of that name. But anyway, good afternoon, good evening. Karen, how are you tonight?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. And you pronounced my name perfectly. You were saying it was a struggle, but that was perfect.
Okay, good.
Thank you for having me on the your program, and good evening to all your listeners. I'm very happy to be here, and it's an honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, Karen did something for us, and I did indicate that to most of you via Facebook. She did make the film available for us to see and prior to this discussion, and it was a free showing, and it was exclusively for this audience. And hopefully some of you were able to see it and watch it. I did post it, as I indicated last week that I would do. So I really appreciate her for doing that as well, because, you know, this is a commercial venture, along with its message that has to get out as well. So, again, I want to thank Karen for doing that, for opening up for our audience to do that. Karen, let's start out by just asking the question, why did you do this film? What was it necessary, you think? What was the motivation behind that?
Basically, what happened was I was working in television in New York, and I read somewhere that Queen Elizabeth was going to be visiting Jamaica in celebration of her 50th anniversary as the Queen of, you know, Britain. And Jamaica is, although Jamaica is an independent country, the Queen is still official as the head of state. And because of whatever legal arrangements were made at independence, and we're still a part of the Commonwealth. So for me, as a child growing up in Jamaica, I remember, you know, being very young and standing in the sun while waiting for what felt like hours for the Queen just to drive by and wave at me. So I thought it would be pretty profound to go, and I just knew that it was going to be drama around her visit. And so I went, and I thought I was going to make a short film about her visit. And, you know, being there was just like a clash of history to see all this stuff unfolding in an independent country. And partly also because I grew up with a lot of history. My grandmother used to tell me a lot of history. History was my favorite subject. And if you grew up in Jamaica, the evidence of slavery is all around you. You don't have to look very far. In the center of my town is where 500 people who had rebelled, you know, enslaved people were hanged in the last rebellion, which actually led to the end of slavery across the British Empire. So anyway, she was visiting, and I thought I'd do something really short. And then while I was there at one event, a group of Rastafari came to petition the Queen for reparations, and I thought that was very dramatic and also, you know, a very visible, tangible statement. And the world press was following the Queen. I mean, the BBC, New York Times, all the media, you know, like the global media that follows a figure as big as the monarchy of England were here. So I thought, oh, wow, this is going to be on the world news. This is going to be everywhere, you know, reparations in Jamaica. And nobody wrote even a story about it. Because to them it was like just a fringe, crazy group of people. But for me, this was like major. So that led me to, you know, so I realized, wow, I have to do a film about this whole thing, and it's not just about this one visit. And that just led me on a journey to, you know, making the film that's the result is The Price of Memory.
Excellent. You know, I'm one of the things that we always like to do on the Black Reality Think Tank, we always like to be clear for our listening audience. We don't take anybody for granted. So I want to maybe ask you if you would kind of, in case there might be some listeners who are not too familiar with the Rastafari movement in Jamaica, if you could just kind of give us a little background of what that is.
Hopefully some viewers saw the film, because I go into the history in the film. But so the Rastafari movement started in the 1930s in Jamaica, and it grew out of when Haile Selassie was crowned as the emperor of Ethiopia in 1930. It was big, not just in Jamaica, but really across the African diaspora. It created Ethiopic movements even in the United States. In the context of Jamaica, it became the Rastafari movement. And the Rastafari movement essentially is a movement looking back to Africa, both physically, like believing in a physical return, as well as a spiritual return, embracing African aesthetic and all of that. Initially, Rastafari didn't have locks. That came later. The first Rastafarians did not have locks, but they moved out of, Jamaica was a very colonial society at the time. We were a British colony. And one of the big tenets of the Rastafari movement was not just on the returning to Africa, but it was repatriation with reparations. Right. You know, the belief that we were entitled to get reparations from the British crown. Mm-hmm. So Rastafari were persecuted, you know, for the belief, and marginalized in Jamaican society for many years. And so basically those are the, you know, people can associate other things, you know, Bob Marley, ganja, and so on. But really, as far as a political, a highly political movement as well as a spiritual movement.
Exactly.
It was looking at rejecting Christianity, really, in the form in which we had, you know, been handed for Christianity. I mean, there were Rastafarians who looked at the Ethiopian, like the Ethiopian text more than the Bible that we got, you know, through the Protestant church.
Right.
So this is a full casting off of British colonials mentality that we had been inculcated with.
Exactly. Okay.
I hope that's...
And I'm glad you said that in that way, too, because a lot of folk do always just kind of associate the Rastafari movement with music and Bob Marley, but it's much,
yeah,
much more than music and Bob Marley. It's a whole philosophical system, as you know. And actually, they were part of the Maroons in the early years of enslavement, correct? Wasn't that the Maroon community as well?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, Maroons are basically across the society.
Okay.
Jamaica has 5 Maroon communities. They're, you know, these are distinct villages, locations, communities that were, you know, they had a history of fighting the British and were signed treaties that were got land.
Okay.
But also, I come from all sectors of Jamaican society, even from the beginning. I wouldn't say they're really necessarily Maroons. The Maroons have a different place, you know.
Okay. Okay.
There are Rastafarians who are also Maroons, who have a Maroon heritage.
Okay. Okay.
But Maroons, certainly, I wouldn't say that Rastafari come from Maroons. You know what I mean? Jamaica has very, lots of different African communities or populations. Because
mm-hmm.
even after slavery ended, Jamaica got groups of, for example, indentured workers from Africa,
okay,
as well as India and China.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, so yeah, they came from all over. It's not just Maroons, but the first Rastafari group was Leonard Howell created Pinnacle. That's a pretty famous place.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed in the film you did focus on the fact that the reparations movement among the Rastafari did not just begin with the Queen Elizabeth incident, that they had been operating for a long time, and I know that was one of your central focuses. Give us a little background of the history of the reparations movement among the Rastafari in Jamaica. When did it start?
Mm-hmm.
What was some of the energy behind that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good question. So basically, from the beginning, Rastafarians in Jamaica were persecuted. They were called mad and imprisoned, you know. The early Rastafarians, some of them died in prison and in the madhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And by the 1960s, when the Mau Mau appeared in Kenya, that Mau Mau rebellion, and we saw the Mau Mau with locks, that inspired the Rastafari in Jamaica to adopt locks because, you know, they also saw themselves as liberators and liberation fighters in Jamaica. So I'm talking now about not just the philosophical, but that look, you know, of rebellion that you see, you know, the locks. So that in itself is, you know, because for Rastafari, it's not just the money alone, but it's the claiming of your history and your story, which for me also is a big part of reparations. You have to know your story before you can claim it. So you have that. But then before even Rastafari, there was a man, a Jamaican man, who was a doctor, and I cannot remember his entire name, but I know his last name was Scholes.
Mm-hmm.
And from like 1901, he wrote a whole treatise on reparations. I didn't put it in the film because I couldn't find the visuals. I couldn't find a way to make it visual, and I didn't feel like it was a story.
Right.
But, you know, I just wanted to say that the idea of reparations actually predates Rastafari because from when Queen Victoria came in, and I can't remember if it's the 1860s, but yeah, it's the 1860s. Former slaves in Jamaica petitioned Queen Victoria for reparations. They were asking for land and money and freedom from the taxes that really the planter class used to pretty much enslave the black population.
Right.
So this is before, you know, the apparent emergence of Rastafari in Jamaica. From the 1860s, you have former enslaved. I mean, Jamaica, slavery ended in Jamaica in 1834 was the official, was a period when former slaves became apprentices. And then by 1838, they cut apprenticeship. It ended at 1838, and then everybody was free at 1838. But by the 1860s, Jamaicans are petitioning Queen Victoria for, you know, reparations. Mm-hmm. And the Queen responds that, no, they should just work harder so that the planter class can pay them more money and they'll be okay. Mm-hmm. That's really one of the, that's really the first that I've found recorded, you know, instance of asking for reparations. So Rastafari emerges by the by 1900, you have other people writing about reparations, but by the 1930s, the Rastafari emerge, and they just become this group that frightens, really, you know, the planter class, Jamaica, yeah, high society, and the British, you know,
okay,
colonial people who are there. And then after that, I mean, Pinnacle, which was the first Rastafari settlement, by the 1950s, it was burnt to the ground. You know, Rastafari were scattered across Jamaica. That, this isn't in the film, because it's not really a history of Rastafari,
right,
but, you know, it's in the story.
Okay.
So they're scattered across Jamaica, and it spreads across Jamaica by the 60s, you know, and then the music, it just becomes this thing that cannot die, and it's everywhere, it's in every song. So in a way, now every Jamaican has heard of reparations or repatriation because of, you know,
okay,
the subsequent generations. So,
and, you know,
oh, and then in the 60s, as well, you have Jamaicans starting, Rastafari starting to directly petition the Queen, writing to the Queen, going to the United Nations. They came to New York to petition the United Nations to get involved because they wanted the British to, you know, give reparations and to help also with repatriation to Africa. And so you have groups in Jamaica petitioning the Queen, writing the Queen, going to the, to finally the Jamaican government agrees to a trip to Africa, which is for various reasons. And in it are Rastafarians as well as Pan-Africanists, and they go to Africa on this trip, which is called this historic mission to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way to Africa, they stop in the UK and then petition the Queen again. It's just an ongoing petition to the Queen. So when she came to Jamaica, really, it was nothing new. I mean, it's new to me seeing it visually, but, you know, it's a long history.
Right.
And it was, yeah, so.
And it's a rich history, too. Yeah, very rich.
Yeah.
You know, Jamaica, I mean, all of the enslavement system in the planet, on the whole planet, was cruel and hard. So I'm not saying that one area is tougher than the other, but I know that there are some real horror stories with Jamaica because of that planter system. And I remember at one time it was called the Spice Islands, and it wasn't the spice based on the product. It was the breaking ground. That's where they would bring the Africans into the Caribbean and break them in order to take them to the Americas. And so they were broken there, and that breaking process was cruel and hard, and there's a lot of literature that has been written on that. Okay, so now as a filmmaker then, you've got a wonderful platform to operate from.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last part. The phone, I'm on a cell phone and it broke.
Okay, I was saying as a filmmaker, you've got a wonderful platform of history that you can pull from to begin to tell this story. What about your resources that you would get? Let's talk about resources. And I know you had listed several. Eric Williams' book, Capitalism and Slavery, with one, and some other things. So talk a little bit about how did you pull together those resources before you ever rolled the camera? You know, what were they?
Well, to be honest, I started shooting first because, you know, I went and I was just filming the Queen in Jamaica. And just there was all the drama around that, and I saw the petition in person. So I really did. Well, no, I mean, you know, I don't even know where to say my history begins because my entire life I've been reading and so on. But specifically for the film, so really, my whole history, you know, informs the film because it's a very highly personal film as well. You know, it's a personal journey film. It's a film that incorporates my own, you know, experience.
Okay.
So I mean, in terms of books, I read so many books, and I don't have my entire bibliography with me because I have another computer. But I did read Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery. I read Orlando Patterson's book, Slavery and Social Death, which is more a comparative look at enslavement. I mean, it focuses on the Americas, and a lot of it is about the Caribbean, and it's a very good book because it's kind of I try to look at enslavement from all the different perspectives, you know, being shipped to the New World and also being born in enslavement, like what would have been the difference. I mean, I thought a lot about it. What you see in the final film, there's a lot more research, you know, to come up with the story.
Right, exactly.
So Orlando Patterson, Eric Williams, I read Vivian Shepherd's Livestock, Sugar, and Slavery. There's this book by, I think he's British, Sugar and Slaves, by Richard Dunn, that one.
I've seen that.
I read narratives from enslaved peoples. I wasn't just looking at Jamaica because I was just looking at slavery in general
right. In
the New World, you know, so I read a lot in the U.S. I can't remember all the books. I mean, I have them, but I don't have them here with me now.
Right.
But the U.S., Brazil, just the New World, and then Jamaica specifically, enslavement before, like in ancient Rome and Greece, you know, because I was looking at the idea of reparations.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Sugar and Slavery, An Economic History of the British West Indies, Livestock, Sugar and Slavery by Vereen Shepherd.
Right.
And I read this book, Thomas Thistlewood in Jamaica, and it's this man who inherits plantations and he comes back, like Diary of a West India Planter, I think that's the name of it.
Okay.
So, you know, they're diaries because it was kind of to see, you know, them writing
right, exactly. What
they were saying and what they were thinking and how they were seeing us, you know. But to me, the most gripping thing ever for me is this one called A Narrative of Events Since the 1st of August. And it's by this young man, I think he's like 24, and he's at the time, okay, so I told you that, you know, enslavement was going to end in 18... So Jamaica had this huge revolt in 1831,
mm-hmm.
And those 500 people who led, you know, a big part of the rebellion, they were hanged in my town square. So when I was a child, I was in the town square when they renamed it after the person who led the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
That's Sam Sharp. That was very traumatic for me because after that, every time I walked in my town square, I was just, mm-hmm. I don't know, spooked because I just realized, wow, 500 people were hanged here. For years until I was probably 19, I couldn't just walk through my town square and not remember. And I don't know why, it's just the way I'm made up. So anyway, I wanted to say that because I think it's important. So 1831, this happens, right? That affects me much how many decades, generations later. So now this man whose narrative I found, he was a young man, like about 24 years old, and
mm-hmm.
in 1834, which is when they decided that they were going to end slavery because it wasn't, you know, we were constantly rebelling, and also it wasn't getting economic for them anymore. So by 1834, they decide, all right, we're going to stop slavery,
mm-hmm.
but before we stop it, the planters, you know, they've been fighting for 10 years in the British Parliament to keep slavery. So they didn't want to just end it. So they said, okay, we're going to make them apprentices. I mean, we're going to learn how to work when we've been working for them for hundreds of years already. So for those 4 years, so the narrative of this man, James Williams, he's just outlining how his life has just turned to hell in the short time since he was an apprentice. And I mean, the story is just so incredible. And, you know, he's beaten, smeared to death, and then he's taken to jail. And when you read his story, you just get a... It's his narrative, so you just see, and slavery has not ended yet,
right?
This is they recorded his narrative in order to try to push to end apprenticeship, and they did end it early. It was supposed to last for 6 years, and they ended it in 1838 because the planters were just trying to get everything out of these slaves before, you know, these people before they had to free them. And when you read his story, you're just like, wow, because, you know, he's on the cusp of manhood. And they're trying to break him. And then he goes to prison, to jail. And that's when I realized, wow, even the people who were in jail, who were like beating them, those people were also slaves, but they were assigned, like their entire, they were basically assigned to just stay at the jail and beat people. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine like that assignment? Mm-hmm. You know, and you're enslaved. So I just realized how learning all of what I learned just really explained Jamaica to me,
right,
explained the society that I grew up in and that, you know, I was born in and inherited,
right,
and even just explained even the U.S. to me, because, you know, I came to America as an immigrant, and then when I understood how slavery worked, everything just made more sense to me.
Right.
So anyway, I can go on and on. Sorry.
And that's why I ask you that question, because I know that Jamaica
mm-hmm.
has some horror stories like that. That was a book that I ran across by Edward Long. It was called The History mm-hmm. of Jamaica. He was a plantation owner, and he was
talking, mm-hmm.
and he did something kind of like what Thomas Jefferson did. Jefferson
mm-hmm.
did a book called Notes on Virginia, and what it was,
right.
his diary, he kept a diary of the activity of the captives, and Edward Long did the same thing. He took notes, and he
wrote
this book.
It sounds very familiar. I'm very sure that's one of the books. I just don't, because there's so many books, you know, that I read, but I'm very sure I read that book because it's very familiar.
Exactly. What about Port The Port Royal
experience. I'm sorry? What about?
Yeah, what about the Port Royal experience? There's a new book that has just come out on Port Royal in Jamaica.
Oh.
That was another in hellhole. And some of the really, really horrible things that happened with that experience.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run across that? Did you embrace that into this work?
I'm not hearing you so clearly. You're saying there's a book about Port Royal that's new, that's out?
Yes, it is. It's out now. It's about,
okay.
It's been out about 2 or 3 years, I think. But
I'm not familiar with the book.
Okay.
I mean, I know quite a bit about Port Royal.
Uh-huh.
You know, but Port Royal sank early in the British, excursion in Jamaica. And I think it's the 1690s that Port Royal sank.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Port Royal was also, you know, a lot of people were brought there and slaves people were brought there and sold there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is when you have all these quote-unquote pirates and... The governor itself of Jamaica was a pirate. You know, they're all criminals, really, that came to the Caribbean to get rich.
Exactly.
So,
well, anyway,
I can't really speak about that particular book, but Port Royal. But Port Royal is the entire island was plantations, though.
I'm sorry.
I'm saying most of Jamaica, most of the island was cut up into plantations.
Except
for the crown lands.
Right.
Or where the Maroons were, but, you know, most of the places further down where they could plant sugar, you know, because Jamaica became very, very important in the British crown. It was, you know, generating great wealth.
Okay.
Later Barbados as well, and, you know, the Caribbean in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the economics. Jamaica, the British crown made a lot of money. From the captivity of African people throughout the world. In your research, what kind of economic explanation can you give our audience to let them know the mega wealth that was
of the system? Right. Well, the British crown from the very beginning was involved in slavery. I mean, the British, they gave, what's the ship, the Jesus of Lubeck? The ship was given, the very first ships that were running for Britain,
right.
The British crown was an investor in it. At one point, the British crown had when you're the sole owner, a monopoly.
Right.
On trading, I think for 30 years the British crown had a monopoly, and then a lot of people fought their way in. So the British crown was invested in slave trade, in transporting enslaved people from Africa to the Americas for 200 years. The British crown had, I know that at emancipation, which is 1838/34, the British Crown had 10 plantations across the Caribbean, three of which were in Jamaica. So, I mean, it's like a very long history. I can't tell you the number, but, you know, I can't give you an estimate, but it's a lot of, you know, hundreds of years of trading and also owning plantations.
Right.
And you also have to look at that in the Caribbean. And, you know, a good book to read is, and it's so funny because after I'd spent years doing this research, this book comes out and it just has everything in there that I'd read. And it's Sir Hilary Beckles' book. What's that book? Britain's Black Debt.
Okay.
That's a book about reparations, and it just has pretty much everything I'm saying now.
Give me the name.
It's encapsulated Britain's Black Debt.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm. By Hilary Beckles, and it's specifically about reparations and Britain and the British Crown.
Okay.
So, going back to but remember also that and what his name talks about this, Eric Williams, that it's not just the crown. You have all these plantations creating industries in Britain that were employing like hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Sugar, the refinement of different goods, cotton, all of these. They created employment in Britain. They also generated taxes for Britain and the crown.
Right.
So, I mean, it's limitless, really. I mean, you know, later you go on to the investment. These people came to the Caribbean, got wealthy, and then created... they invested in everything, insurance, shipping, banking, they built universities, you know, the pace of Britain, all these institutions. The Bank of England was created to, you know, manage the money. I mean, Lloyd's of London was created, again, from insurance, Barclays Bank,
right.
You know.
Barclays, yep, exactly. And you know, it's
really not just the crown, it's the entire structure.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, you know, they were in India and all these other places, but I'm saying that that's enslavement for those hundreds of years, you know, generated so much money, not just for the crown, but the country.
Right, and exactly. And that's, I mean, because it was a global action. France, Spain, the Dutch. And
right.
They all were involved in it, and they were all working together in some cases. And so, obviously, the reparations would have to look at all of them. And, I mean, I understand the Rastafari going after the British Crown first because that's where they are. But very clearly, France has got to pay. Spain has got to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Portugal has got to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and obviously, if you're going to talk about reparations, you got to look at the wealth structure and, you know, how it was developed. Let me ask this, the lawsuit, and then I'm going to open up the lines to our callers. We have some folk online now. You specifically focused in on the lawsuit, and you talked about what the court said was a problem and why they would not honor the lawsuit. You indicated, I think, two reasons. One of them was the fact about the injured and being able to prove who is it that was injured, number one. And then the second one was, you know, kind of looking at the whole idea of, you know, how you would accumulate that wealth and who was involved, the fact that slavery was legal during the time that Britain was in it. So talk a little bit about that for us. And maybe give us the name of the law. I know that there's a specific law firm in Jamaica that's handling this lawsuit. And maybe just kind of give out listening audience a little background of that.
All right, so let me back up a little bit. I think you're referring to the terms on which they rejected the claims. And what happened was, I think your viewers may be aware of the World Conference Against Racism that happened in Durban in 2001. It was a UN conference that was specifically about racism, but really particularly focused on reparations. All these countries from all over and NGOs, etc., gathered in South Africa, and they wanted an agreement around reparations. And Britain pulled out. There were EU countries that actually were ready to sign to say that slavery was a crime against humanity and should have always been, because it's very... Yeah, it's legalese, but it's very, it would be essential, because if Britain conceded that slavery was a crime against humanity, then they're open to reparations claims.
Right.
So in the end, the agreement said that, But in the end, basically, it's in the film too, that they said it wasn't a crime against humanity. You know what I mean? Like, when Rastafari wrote The Queen, she said it was not a crime. Like, it should have been, but it wasn't.
Okay.
So therefore, she's not liable.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's kind of what, that's the language that the developing world was kind of hammered into accepting. Although a lot of them were there pushing to have them agree that it was a crime against humanity. I mean, it is a crime against humanity. There's the Nuremberg Tribunal and all these other things that happened around the Holocaust already showed that it was a crime against humanity. So now to backtrack and say it wasn't doesn't make any sense. But anyway, so that's what happened. So now, what CARICOM... So when I was finishing the film, CARICOM was just beginning to... I think there's a scene in the film where you may have seen where I kind of, I asked the Jamaican Prime Minister of the time what Jamaica was going to do about reparations.
Right.
I kind of bum rushed that conference.
Okay,
and,
hello?
Hello?
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
No,
so basically what happened was, it's at the point, no, they're not in a lawsuit. What has happened is CARICOM has created, CARICOM meaning the Community of Caribbean Countries. It's like the EU. It's a Caribbean regional political body and an economic trading bloc as well.
Okay.
So what they've done is create a commission to research and prepare for reparations. And remember, this is a region that does not have a lot of the resources that you would require to launch a lawsuit such as this. And even now, Britain is pulling out of the EU, you know, so I don't know what the next steps are, what that would mean for CARICOM's actions with reparations, but what CARICOM is asking for is not really a dollar amount so much. They have a 10-point plan.
Okay.
And the 10-point plan, so this is, so they have a commission, they have created a center of reparations, they're academics, they're all kind of different policy people who are working on this commission to bring legal actions for reparations against the seven European countries. And they haven't launched a lawsuit. They've done research and whatever to bring a lawsuit. Ironically, the first information I had was that they had hired a law firm in the UK,
okay.
but it's a law firm that successfully brought the case of the Mama for reparations from Britain. Because, you know, they basically had a genocide in Kenya and slaughtered, I don't know how many thousands of people.
Okay.
When they had a Mama rebellion in Kenya.
Right.
So those people, that law firm is who had represented them, and this is the same firm that CARICOM was hiring.
Okay.
I don't know if they still have them now. So, but what CARICOM is asking for is they want the EU to fund repatriation for those who want to return, like to create that kind of scheme.
Right.
They want them to invest in cultural institutions, public health. The Caribbean has a public health crisis, which is directly a result of like slavery. I mean, diabetes, all kind of different issues.
Yeah.
It stemmed from that history, illiteracy eradication, technology transfer, debt cancellation, which is really, to me, one of the most pressing issues, indigenous people's development and repatriation. But when we talk about cultural institutions, it's very important because, for example, my cousin did her PhD in history, and she's specifically studying a particular period in Jamaica, you know, children in Jamaica at a certain point. And she has to go to the UK to get all of these documents. Like, pretty much the entire region, you know, they hold a lot of the archives. They hold a lot of our cultural knowledge. I mean, you may know that the British Museum has, you know, all this stuff that they looted all over the world. But so even the returning the returning culturally relevant artifacts and information, giving us access to them.
Okay.
Funding the public health crisis, funding illiteracy eradication, funding technology transfer and debt cancellation. It's not really like just giving money to, you know, a generation of people. And I should say that illiteracy education eradication is really important, because when the Britain was giving Jamaica independence, I mean, over 70% of the population was illiterate. You know, they act as if, oh, you know, they gave you something. But how do you create a country where the majority is illiterate?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Good question. Let me ask, just for our audience sake, Deb, tell us what that word CARICOM means again. Just explain that. I know it's the Caribbean Association. But
it's Caribbean Community.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
So actually, if you want a lot of information about the reparations, the 10-point reparations plan, it's at caricomreparations.org, CARICOM, reparations.org.
All right.
And there's a center at the University of the West Indies in Mona, in Kingston, Jamaica,
okay,
that's specifically dedicated to reparations as well.
All right. Now, I'm going to open up the lines for our audience, but the one last question that I'd like to ask before I do that, what do you want this film to be able to do? What is the goal and objective of A Price of Memory?
Wow.
I know it's an educational piece.
Yeah, that's a big question. Well, for me, I made this film because I saw, you know, I was a witness to history, and I saw something very historic happening, people pursuing reparations, and a lot of people thought I was crazy when I was doing it. And also, so I wanted it to just be a witness that we were not silent, that we did pursue it, and we did have a... What the film is about is not even really the pursuit as much as the establishment that there is a case for reparations.
Okay.
You know, a lot of it, we didn't even know... A lot of Jamaicans didn't know the history of the whole struggle for reparations even there. You know, that... From the 1860s to now, people have been talking and struggling for reparations in Jamaica.
Okay.
It's not new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to record that for posterity, really. And I just wanted people to know it wasn't, I mean, I don't think it's, I guess it can be a call to action if you don't know.
Okay.
But I never really saw myself as, I guess, you know, an activist as much as a witness to history, and I'm an artist. So, yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
And I want to just say the cinematography is fantastic in that film, and you really did a masterful job.
Thank you.
Of that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Because, you know, at the end of the day, my job is still to create a powerful story, you know. It's centered around the one Rastafari man, Ras Lion, who was there, and you know, his story.
Exactly.
So...
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like the elderly gentleman who said that he said he uses the Bible as his law book. Something he said, and he was an elderly gentleman. He was.
Oh yeah, that's Brother Fillmore Alvarenga.
Yeah,
he's one of the three Rastafari men who went to Africa on their own. Like after they found their own money and went, and they lived in the palace with Haile Selassie.
Excellent. Okay, let's...
Yeah, he's a very nice man.
Yeah. Let's open up the lines and see if our audience has anything to say. Good afternoon, Brother Timothy. How are you? Are you any words of encouragement or questions you have here?
Oh, lots of words of encouragement, sir, and I appreciate you having this guest. And I studied film in graduate school and always realized it was a tool of importance. You know, so I appreciate what she has done, but I want to talk about the relationship with America and our people in the Caribbean. And I'm going to say I like what you did, and I'm going to say this, that what America has done and what a lot of people have done with resources is rate all of the resources and the good riches that Jamaica has. And when I went to Jamaica in 2012, I went to a resort. One day, wanted to go back to visit and talk to my people. And you know, I have to say that I didn't like what the British Crown did to Jamaica, and I didn't like what has done to Haiti throughout the years. And you exposing what slavery took place and what happened in Jamaica, and one of my heroes is a gentleman by the name of, his name is Dudley Bookman, mm-hmm. and he mm-hmm. was a slave in Jamaica. He winds up in Haiti, and he fights mm-hmm. the Haitian Revolution mm-hmm. before Toussaint Overshoot. So, mm-hmm. man, keep up the good work, and I'm willing to listen to learn more about what you do in your country.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Sister Vanessa Rye on Greensboro, 336. Okay, I thought that was...
I'm sorry. Did you say something to me? My phone kind of...
No, I was opening up the line for 336-317.
Hold up. Can you hear me?
Good afternoon.
Yes.
How are you?
Yes, green. Listen, I want to call back on my home phone because I hear, you know, the cell phone issues. So just give me a few minutes, but I'm still listening.
Okay, sounds great.
Okay.
All right. 225 Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I didn't
hear
clearly.
Good evening, everyone. I didn't have a chance to actually watch the film, so I'm kind of at a loss. I was kind of curious about you had said that there was that you were disappointed that there seemed to be some resistance to reparations that hadn't existed before. Can you elaborate on that? You said the Nuremberg trials basically established that slavery was wrong, but now there's some attitude that's resisting that. And is there more that you can say about that?
Yeah, I think the Nuremberg trials established that, but there were also, you know, there were later reparations. The concept of reparations isn't new. You have the reparations to the Japanese in World War II. There's earlier reparations before that, wars in Europe, etc. British had given reparations to the Maoris in New Zealand, but for African people, you know, it's just, I mean, if you think about it, Eric Williams' book was not as accepted when it came out, although we look at it now like, of course, it's... They're just now doing more research to say, yeah, he was right. But, I mean, anybody who's lived it knows that reparations is kind of a no-brainer. So, but it was not like it was a new concept, you know. But it's convenient for them not to know, you know. So, it's ironically, I remember Fillmore Alvarenga, the same older gentleman that you said you liked, he told me that where he first discovered about England's participation in the British Crown, participation in the slave trade, was actually in England when he went to research at that famous place? Okay. Abbey, Westminster Abbey. You know, because they have books about it. So, okay. But they didn't expect that you would also be seeking reparations at some point. But I wanted to speak to what you were saying about Haiti, because I spent a lot of time deliberating on putting a whole segment in the film about Haiti until I decided that, no, I just had to focus on Jamaica, because Jamaica alone was so much. Because I was in Jamaica when President Aristide was ousted from Haiti. And before, you know, before that, I...
Okay. Brother Pugh, was that what you had in the question you had?
Well, I can ask it another way. We had our president today basically say that he claimed that there's some economic relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that justifies ignoring the murder that was committed in Turkey. And so I was wondering is whether or not there's a change in attitude that sort of reflected in sort of the attitude of the current president. That was the thinking I was thinking that I had. So
I'm back. I was cut off.
Okay. What about Tony Blair? Did Tony Blair accept the process of reparations as the prime minister during the time? Because he was around doing some of that.
Right. No, in 2007, I think England commemorated that they had ended the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And they put in all these activities in Jamaica. At that point, again, Tony Blair wrote this thing where he had deep regret about slavery, but it wasn't an apology. Because if they start an apology, then it becomes, you know, they're liable.
Right.
So he didn't accept that England needed to pay reparations.
Yeah, he did.
He just expressed deep regret about slavery.
Right.
And I think the Church of England they gave an apology. But they did express regret. All these British, very British institutions. And then what England did is that they put in place from the lottery in England. They put money towards studying what happened with the compensation money, because Britain had paid all the the owners of enslaved people, they paid them £20 million, which would be billions of dollars today. But they paid them, they did pay reparations, but not to the enslaved people. They paid it to the people who were freeing, the enslaved people.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They turn around to study what happened to it, and now they're establishing things that we already knew that, yeah, you know, the money went into funding all these British institutions that exist today.
Right. And, you know, all of that apology stuff is worthless. I know Bill Clinton even had the nerve to go to Ghana and apologize, you know, but what? Well, he didn't apologize.
Yeah.
Stephanie said it was wrong.
Yeah, but not.
It's an insult.
Yeah, well, even recently, Macron, the French president, they opened this huge place in Guadeloupe, I believe. Yeah, it's in Guadeloupe, and it's about, you know, like a museum of enslavement. And,
right.
But again, you know, they wouldn't give Haiti back the money that Haiti wanted, although they're clear there was a case. And that's why they also there is food, because the Caribbean was going to join with him, and he was getting people, you know, in other countries,
right,
that were going to support him at the UN, etc. So that's really why, you know, they said he was, whatever they said, I can't remember what they said. They always come up with a story. But they ousted him, and, yeah, that was, you know.
Okay.
I wonder what would happen to reparations at that point, because I was kind of surprised. I thought his reparations claim was going to die in the Caribbean.
Right.
Because I was there when all these leaders from the Caribbean gathered in Jamaica and to talk about how Aristide was definitely put on a plane. He was flown to Central African Republic. He didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he demanded, you know, to be taken from there. So that shows he didn't agree to go. And then they took him to South Africa. No, eventually ended up in South Africa, but they actually brought him back to Jamaica. And I think it was, anyway, Bush, you know, threatened Jamaica and said, you know, this is like an act of aggression against the United States for you to harbor President Aristide. So I thought, you know, and Aristide was big at the time, was really pressing for restitution. And I thought it would have frightened the Caribbean into nuts. I mean, I have the whole press conference when it was very shocking, actually.
Right.
You know, probably about 14 prime ministers from the region, and they were saying, you know, how he was put on, when he stopped in Antigua for them to refuel the plane, they didn't say he was on board. They just said it was cargo. So they were taking him to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So they definitely set out to stop the whole restitution, because of Haiti had a very strong claim, because Haiti was paying restitution up until the 1950s. Haiti was paying that money, the money from after the Haitian Revolution that they were forced to pay,
right,
beginning after the 1820s. That money was paid until the 1950s, actually, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a very strong claim to get that back, and then once, if that went through, then it would just, you know, it would just ricochet, really.
Okay.
So they had to kill that.
Okay. All right. Let's area code 404, 453, caller.
Hey, Dr. Rodney, how you doing? And the guest, hey, this is a good show. Oh. Hey, see, I'd like to go forward, okay, on the court cases that y'all do have. Okay. And see, I got two questions.
Sure.
Did y'all ever think about going after the evil one, the Catholic Church, and the Rothschilds and the Luna brothers?
Okay.
Them the main two. And I got one more question after that, if you can answer that first.
Okay. In your research, Sister Karen, were you able to go back that far and look? Because I know some of those banks and organizing banks had a lot to do with the Rothschilds. And I know the Rockefellers had their hand in some of that. Did you find others outside of the Crown that were intricate parts of that stuff?
Were you asking, did I find others outside of the Crown that were part of slavery?
Were part of the economic structure of slavery, you know, the whole, you know.
Right. Oh, okay, right. Yeah, so you mean in Britain?
Yeah, in Britain. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. You have Lloyd's of London, which is the insurance company in England that still exists. I mean, they basically used to insure enslaved people. That it started from that. Okay. You have
what about the Catholic Church?
Not, well, in England, it's the Church of England. They own slaves. That's why after 2007, they made this big apology about them owning slaves, and they admit, because they even got the reparations money that they paid to the owners. The Church of England got money. So, you know, like, literally, they got reparations money from the government. Universities, I mean, the trains, I mean, you know, the money to create a train system. I don't know where to start. The Bank of England. Most of the major institutions came out of that. Tate and Lyle was a shipping company, a sugar company. You have the Tate Museum in England. I mean, the people who founded the founders of Tate and Lyle created this huge, it's like one of the most, you know, prestigious museums in the world. And you have the Tate Modern. Those came from slavery as well.
What about Captain Morgan Rum and all them? You see what I'm saying? It's a whole big group. My last question is, in lieu of the Queen and all that, you know, Queen Charlotte was black. So going forward now, with this marriage to that that lady from America, that Meghan, see, she black. Would y'all gonna try to go out? Maybe y'all might get somewhere talking to her if y'all get to that American girl. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that's married to the son. Okay?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's.
She's a part of the whole structure now. So
Mama black is really like 12:30. You see what I'm saying? You might have to go through her mom and then through her. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
That's a good point. I don't know.
That's a whole
I think, story. You know, it's more about really going to the legally, you know, it's not even about the Crown, really. It's the government. Because remember what I'm saying? It's the entire country. They got taxes for hundreds of years from it. So we're not really, the Caribbean right now is not really focused on the Crown. I mean, you know, I use the Crown because if you look at the British Crown as this kind of fairy tale, beautiful empire thing, but it's not. You know, their whole history is very bloody.
Okay.
So, you know, that's kind of why I talk about it, but it's really more than just the Crown. It's basically the country. You know, Britain became wealthy. It's a wealthy country. Just like in the United States became wealthy from enslavement. I mean, Harvard University, all of these major universities, for some enslavement. I mean, right now I'm doing a short film about a woman named Belinda, and she was the first person in Massachusetts to get, she basically argued for her pension because she had been enslaved for over 50 years. She was brought from Antigua in the Caribbean to Massachusetts, and she was enslaved by the same family. They brought her from the Caribbean and brought her to Massachusetts, and when she was like 70, at the time of the war in America, the Revolutionary War, the people who owned her ran off back to England, and she filed a petition, and she won her pension. You know what I mean? And that was unprecedented, and that enabled other enslaved people to get their pension in the United States. So I'm saying, you know, and the people who owned her are the people who started Harvard. You understand?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of the institutions in the United States, it's the same. I mean, it's a structure, it's a system that was there for hundreds of years that, you know, generated immense wealth.
So my final question is, what do you think about, you know, England is kicking out them Jamaican, what they call them, the spooks or what? That they kicking
the Windrush people?
Yeah, the Windrush. What do you think about that?
Well, okay. I mean, the thing is, there's nobody that agrees with that, right? Because when those people went to England, they were British subjects. They were literally British citizens or whatever. But England didn't really want, they needed, all right. If you saw the film, you'll see that England rebuilt themselves after the war by getting resources from their colonies, right? In Jamaica, we had bauxite. Bauxite is what, did you see the film?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I know what bauxite is.
Okay, so bauxite has, aluminum comes from bauxite. Aluminum at the time was made to make, you know, like nuclear weapons, all of these things that were valuable to the United States. So then Britain gave the United States this resource. Jamaica had the biggest amount in the world. And Jamaica, the country, got 1% of the value of bauxite, okay? It was sold to Alcan and all these American aluminum countries. So Britain used that money to rebuild, because remember, Britain was destroyed after World War II, right? You know, Germany, So that's how they recovered, and, you know, they never really got back to their glory as the United States rose to become the world power. But that's part of how they did it, because they got the resources. You get what I'm saying? So
yes, ma'am.
It's all connected. You know what I mean? Like, it's all connected, but we're just thinking, oh, you know, but remember, once you have somebody as a colony, you can constantly rape them. You can constantly get whatever is valuable from the country, you know? So they left Jamaica without educating the population, but they were taking the one natural resource that we have. Okay. And that's not new. I mean, it's everywhere that Britain goes, you know, not necessarily Britain, just colonial. That's just the nature of a colonial power.
All right. I appreciate it, Doc. Man, you get somebody's call. Stay strong, stay black. 2019 is our year. The 400 years is up.
Okay.
I appreciate it, Doc.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Sister Karen, I'm going to take a quick break, station break, and we're going to come back. I have a young lady that's back on, and a brother from Newport News, Virginia, wants to say a couple of things. But right now, we'll take a break. Get your glass of water, another cup of tea, and we'll be right back, okay?
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight. Get 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy, she's good for a start. Get 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Get 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look, see. Cause I know you'll want her once you've seen her. She's young and right, make a darn good breeder. Bid her in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid her in, get her in. Here's a bid of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 325, can I hear 350? Your money ain't earning you much in the banks. Turn around, Roy, let him look at her flanks. Bid her in. 350's bidding, I'm looking for 4. At $400, she's a bargain, sure. 4 is the bid, 450. 5, $500, now look alive, bid them in, get them in. Don't mind them tears, that's one of her tricks. 550's bidding, who'll say 6? She's healthy and strong and well-equipped. Make a fine lady's maid when she's properly whipped. Bid them in. 6, 650, don't be slow. 7 is the bid, gonna let her go. At 7, she's going, going, gone. Pull her down, Roy, bring the next one on. Bid them in, get them in, bid them in.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me and before. My grave and go home.
are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
I just want to mention to our listening audience that there is a call-in number if you desire to ask a question of our guest or either to make a remark. The number is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And you are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. and we are broadcasting on the platform or timeforanawakening.com. Let me just quickly mention there are several other programs that are a part of this network. On Mondays from 11 to 1, we have African Perspectives with Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, who is the host. That's every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Very dynamic program, wonderful discussion and guests. He is also the executive director for Motherland Media Network, who also sponsors the Black Reality Think Tank here on this program. So, Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 to 1 p.m. And then on Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 Eastern Time, you have Acres of Diamond. Acres of Diamond with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And then at 8 p.m. on Mondays Eastern Time, we have Let's Buy Black 365. Let's Buy Black 365 on Monday evenings at 8 p.m. right here on timeforanawakening.com. And then obviously on Tuesday, we have the Black Reality Think Tank. And then on Wednesday, African Perspectives, as I said again. And then we have a program called Revive, Proof of Consciousness, by Proof of Consciousness, that comes on to Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Fridays, Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. They are on the air from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time right here. Brother Richard, Brother Elliot, Time for an Awakening. And they are broadcasting out of Philadelphia, very dynamic guests, interesting conversations always. And then on Saturday, we have the Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. Saturday Sports Talk, Troy Wilmore from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on Time for Awakening. And then on Sunday, we have Revive again with Proof of Consciousness from 11 to 1 on Sunday at Eastern Time, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then on Sunday evening, we have Time for an Awakening again with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot, and they air from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And that is the lineup here at timeforanawakening.com. You could also go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com, and go to the archive. And there is a wonderful collection of all of our programs that are there. Do that. The Black Reality Think Tank also produces a program called Gospel Gold, which comes on Saturday evenings as well. It's the history of gospel music. And Reverend Michael Rogers does that program. He has a wonderful catalog and repertoire of gospel music and talks about the history of that and how it impacts the African-American community. So with that, let us get back to our conversation. We're talking with Sister Karen. She has done a wonderful film called The Price of Memory. She is here to discuss her film and the work that she has done, talking a little bit about the reparations movement in Jamaica among the Rastafari, and looking at how it has taken shape and mold. And we are discussing some things. Let's go to the line for area code 336-621. Good afternoon, caller.
Good evening. How are you, Doc?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing great.
And good evening to the sister. Please repeat your name.
Good evening, sister. I'm Karen Marks Mafundikwa.
Okay. I'll look on the...
This is Garmin Karen.
Karen. Okay. But I like to use that culture name now, so I'll get it. Thank you so much for the film. I watched it last night, and it was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate the work that you have done and that you're doing. So I want to make a couple of comments because the film actually touched me very deeply. A couple of things that stood out for me. One is that European oppression and global domination, that system, they are not interested, nor will they give any kind of reparations to African people. That's not going to happen. I don't believe that's going to happen. There have been so many efforts from so many people across the globe, and there's just refusal. They'll barely eke out an apology, which I have no desire for. They need to repair the damage that they've done. So that's my thought on the reparations issue. And in relation to reparations, I want to throw out a question about the masses and getting this information to the masses, because I say this all the time, the masses are woefully ignorant. You know, we don't know our history as oppressed people across the diaspora. We don't know what to fight for. We don't know what happened. And that's why these types of films, for me, are so important to be used as a teaching tool. So I learned a lot last night. And I was thinking of Dr. Clark when he said, you know, that we should use, well, he was speaking in terms of religion, but we should use everything as a weapon for our liberation. So these types of films could be used as weapons for our liberation. So what about getting this out to the masses so that we can understand more about what's happened to us across the diaspora? I'd like your input on
okay.
that.
Okay, so basically, how have I've shown it a lot in, no, I've shown it to some extent in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, been shown for schools. Now, actually, the Reparations Commission in Jamaica is going to be rolling it out across, so at least in Jamaica, people know. But it's been seen quite a lot in Jamaica just by regular people because a lot of people didn't know a lot of the history also there.
Mm-hmm.
I've shown, it's brought me to 10 countries. Like I've been across, I toured the UK with it. Even regular people, you know, not regular, even British, white British people didn't know. And they were like, whoa, they didn't know this history.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, two Scottish women saw it and they said, we never read any of this in school. And they brought the film to Scotland, and it was even shown at, like, the Glasgow City Council, and there's a lot of activity there around, post-colonial history. And but it's mostly used in education.
Mm-hmm.
It's shown in a lot of universities in America. Not a lot, but quite a few universities in the U.S. Have it in the curriculum, or they'll buy the film for their, you know, it's used in different classes around history and so on. But for the masses, I don't know. I've tried. I tried to get it on PBS, and I was a finalist on, you know, those documentary series. And then in the end, they said they were afraid to put on a film that advocates. I mean, to me, there are lots of things that come on TV that have an opinion. But the film, basically, I think there's like one line that shows my opinion. You know what I mean? Out of an 8 to 3 minute film. But, you know, that's their position. I had a big back and forth with the BBC because they wanted to acquire it for broadcast. And then in the end, the BBC said they didn't know what channel they could put it on, you know. Although they approached me because I had a big screening in London. It's shown all over. I had a big screening in London, and after that they realized, wow, you know, like I had a full, very kind of, it's like, very kind of prestigious place, and it was packed, so they thought, whoa, all these black people came out, so they were going to put it on TV, but then some people on the team didn't want it on TV, so basically, the people who were the gatekeepers for media are always kind of nervous about the film. I really don't know why, because I didn't make any of it up. It's all, you know, facts.
That's why they're afraid.
Yeah, I showed this film in Harlem. A teacher saw it at a festival. He's like, you have to come to my school and show it. I showed it in Harlem at a public school, And this little white boy came to me afterwards and he said, I can't understand why Britain won't give reparations.
He said what?
A little white boy, he was like 12 years old. He said, I can't understand why Britain won't give reparations. Mm. And after I saw that, I said, that's why they don't want to put it on TV, because he's just a regular kid and he could see, he could understand.
Exactly, exactly. And that's,
you know,
what I'm pointing,
yeah,
you know, getting the masses involved, because I believe that the more the masses learn these truths, it may serve to unify us, you know, especially because we've all, you know, those of us in America have gone through the same thing. Those of us in Africa have gone through the same thing. Jamaica, Haiti, you know, it's the same devil, same methods of torture and enslavement. Now, the other thing I want to say, it touched me very personally. I grew up in Brooklyn, and I grew up around a lot of Jamaicans, Puerto Ricans, Trinidadians, Haitians, you name it. And we were pitted against each other. And I said that this often and needs to be said 1,000 times. We were pitted against each other. So each mm-hmm. one of us did not like the other. We had no idea why we didn't like Jamaicans. We had no idea why we didn't like Trinidadians. And, you know, they didn't know why they didn't like us. You know, there were little narratives that we would repeat, you know, and parrot. But mm-hmm. we really didn't mm-hmm. know why we didn't like each other,
right.
You know. And it was just the European, you know, oppressor finding ways to divide and conquer us. And two things, so as a young person not liking Jamaicans, when I grew up, I started thinking about it. Why do I not like my brothers and sisters once I really got conscious? And I realized the extreme strategies that go into dividing us. So films like this showing, you know, what happened in Jamaica, the same thing that happened to us, could actually help to unite us. The other thing is that when you talk about in the film the fear, how the Europeans made us afraid of our spirituality, that was very powerful, because African spirituality, I believe, is a part of our solution.
Right.
But if you have us afraid of our spiritual systems, then, you know, that also keeps us stuck. And the last piece I want to mention, which was mind-blowing, is the you were in some place you were filming, and one of the guys, European guys, said that the African is extremely forgiving, so it'll be going against the grain to get them stirred up about this issue of reparations.
Yeah, that was the British Parliament. They were debating reparations.
That was so mind-blowing, because it's so true.
Right.
And I just want to say, in our end here, we have to stop being so forgiving. We have to find a way to stop it. Because all the things that I just mentioned, you know, I pulled out the things that keep us stuck, that keep us divided, and waiting on somebody to do something for us. We've got to find a way to take it or make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And these are some, and I'm speaking as a revolutionary, these are some of the things that keep us stuck. We keep on forgiving people that murder, torture, and do all these horrible things to us, then we can forget about it. So thank you. I want to just say that. And thank you again for the film, because it was fantastic. And keep doing what you're doing.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I'm really glad that it touched you, you know?
I say.
It means a lot to me. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sister Yan, always. Thank you. Hold on. We still got a little bit more to go. I want to go to Brother Griffin, Newport News, Virginia. Good afternoon, Brother Griffin.
Good afternoon. Another great one, Dr. Rogers.
Thank
Sister
you,
Karen.
Thank you.
I noticed a couple, so much in that film. I'd like to be able to sit with you and try to figure out how much you threw away on the editing floor, because you have some jewels in there. I'll try to make it quick, because I really want to hear your voice. When you talked about Jamaica only getting 1%, it's kind of funny, because part of the reason no processing was done in Jamaica is because if they were to build up the infrastructure with the amount of energy it takes to process it, the business could be nationalized and taken away. So these people knew exactly what they were doing when they took the raw material and processed it somewhere else. So that's got something else to do with one of my things I like to check into. And the other thing is how much this cause for reparation actually parallels what happened in the United States, because basically what they've done here with reparations cases is claim that there's no direct lineage to prove who was harmed. I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that suit, because, yeah, Brother Miguel Loren brought the lawsuits specifically, and they were saying that he would have to show that he's a direct descendant of, you know, like he had to show the specific lineage and how he had to directly connect himself to as a descendant of an enslaved person to even begin to get reparations, you know? And yeah, that's the argument that's always used, really. But that's why, I don't know if you remember where even the Attorney General was saying that they should just make it a political thing because there's those personal suits weren't going to, they needed more backing than that. That's why it became this regional thing, you know? And a part of why I felt like it was important to put a big emphasis on the Rastafari involvement is because they were the vanguards of the whole movement in the Caribbean from the get-go. And now, in a way, it's kind of become this very kind of political, structured thing, and you'd almost forget their claim for repatriation in it, you know what I mean? Which I think is also important, because if you think about it, the Jewish people got the right to return 2,000 years after leaving, you know, quote, Israel. So I feel like it's natural if African people want to return to Africa 500 years later, it's just their natural right. So I think that that claim is an important part of reparations that's often not discussed or talked about.
Oh, I agree 100%, because what I'm saying is when I hear people say, they're never going to give us reparations, the truth is, we haven't come together to fight for it in the right way is right, what really right. is the problem in my mind. And I mean, I've looked at it from several different ways. We have to come together and fight it just as your film kind of points to. I wouldn't be able to tell you how to make it drill in any closer, but you've hit really on what the big thing is. We're not going at it the right way, because everybody wants to try to make it personal when in fact it was a harm done to a collective.
Collective, right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, a
couple of years ago when I was making this film, I went to, like, you know, in Cobra in the U.S.
Right.
There was a lot of activity around reparations in the U.S. I haven't heard a lot of it. I mean, I've seen, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates giving lectures about reparations, and, you know, those are kind of the spaces that are not really, a lot of the masses are there, but it's kind of gotten quiet. But there've been, you know, NCOBRA is still meeting and working on it, but it's just not getting the press. And I feel like a lot of the people involved in reparations have been that vanguard who've been there since like the 70s, you know,
right.
And it needs almost a mobilization of youth to understand. There's also no the history, really, you know, it's just not in the curriculum.
Right.
And there are so many kids who have seen this film and they're like, this is not in the curriculum at all.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the stuff I had to go out of my way to research. That's why it took me so long. And that's also why I kept doing it, because I was learning so much doing it, you know. So I think a big part of it is, like, it has to be in the curriculum. I don't understand how you can have a structure that, on which the country is built, and it's just not in the curriculum.
Right.
You know, I feel like people need to, even those things should be things that are voted about. I don't know.
Did you mention in the film something about Queen Mother Moore being
Queen Mother Moore?
Was she involved in the Jamaican part of that? I know she was in the American part, but did she?
Yeah, I know of her, but I don't know a lot about her.
Okay.
In Jamaica, no, not really. I mean, maybe, and I don't know. But what I know was, I was looking at the, you know, first I looked at the Rastafari, that whole movement. And then I was looking at the political action, which is really, you know, academic, driven by academics. Like Vereen Shepherd, who I interview in the film, she's a big reparations proponent. She's actually the chairperson of the, you know, the Jamaica Commission, and it just became this big activity across the region, but it was largely driven by more like academic people, right. You know, those exactly. kind of policy and professors who are also activists.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the spiritual part, like Queen Mother Moore, I don't know that she's not, that she is.
I thought it was, you know, she had a connection involved, with
she could
of,
be.
She had a connection with the Rastafari community, and that was the reason why she was there. She had a connection with the Rastafari movement.
Okay.
Yeah. And,
okay. Okay.
Yeah. But let me ask Let me ask this question.
Probably I've just been short in there. Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm just struggling to make sure I'm hearing you.
Yeah, as a filmmaker, if you were going to document the impact of trauma on Africans today from slavery, you know, that whole lineage connection piece, what would, you know, and I know you can't give me the whole agenda of how you would do it, but what would be a way, a process to begin to document how slavery impacts African people today? What would be a way as a filmmaker?
That's such a big question.
Yeah,
the impact of slavery on African people today, like the diaspora, right. or Jamaica?
Let's go in the diaspora, you know, just in general.
Okay, yeah. The impact.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, it's everything, really. It's how we, it's the family structure, it's the diet, it's the knowledge of history,
okay.
it's the knowledge of African spirituality. I mean, it's not as if we don't have practices of revering our ancestors, but that's the religion that we knew.
Okay.
So it's just, you know, the body itself, you know, in Jamaica, for example, 90% of enslaved women were prostituted. I mean, that was widespread, you know, so if you think of how now we know that trauma passes from generation to generation,
okay.
think about how that would impact, you know, the breakup of family. And I say this because, you know, I was married in an African family and I saw the big difference on how they saw family as opposed to how we see family.
Okay.
You know, like our concept of family. But it's just so, I would say that the biggest thing is we've been taught to be ashamed of it. But to me, there's nothing to be ashamed of. We are so resilient that we survived it. You know, a system that was just made to break you. I mean, when you came to Jamaica, for example, the average person who was shipped to Jamaica only lived 9 years. Mm. 9 years. Mm. That's how violent that system was. Mm. So the average person. So they were constantly shipping in new people, as opposed to the U.S. I don't know, different dynamics. There were more people who were born until 1807 when the British ended slavery there. When they stopped the trade, they knew that they had to have a population. So they spent more, they changed the laws. They called it amelioration, where they made it nicer.
Right.
So you could, you know, survive and have children, etc. But I'm saying we're just so fractured, but at the same time, we're so resilient because we still have so much. Like even here, for example, I was in Mississippi 2 years ago, and I was so surprised to find similarities, you know, like patois, words in patois in Jamaica, which are African words, literally people knew in Mississippi. I just couldn't believe it,
right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it's two-pronged in that for us, we need to look at how we serve. We don't know enough about it. We just know, oh, we don't want to hear another slave movie, but how did we survive?
Right.
You know?
Right.
How did families stay intact? I mean, yeah, they broke up the family, but you know, even all of those histories that exist now about people trying to find their families after slavery ended.
Yeah.
And the narratives that we have passed down, to me, those are so important, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so, but it's just on multiple levels, really. Even the diet that we were fed,
right.
You know,
so
is part of the diseases we have. So
that would be a major research piece, wouldn't it? It would be a major...
Yeah. I know that the UN has, they have that slave, they have a big project about, because you know that this decade is supposed to be the decade of people of African descent.
Right.
The United Nations has declared, I think it started like 2 years ago, but there's a lot of activity at the United Nations, you know, they have the cultural section or whatever, around that. And I know that there's a lot of research. I mean, I've been to, the UN has a program in New York City called Remember Slavery, and it's in March. March 25 is designated as a day to remember, you know.
Okay.
I don't know why that date was chosen. But anyway, I think some of it is online, but it's really excellent.
Right.
Because even to know that African people were in the Americas and they were not enslaved, like they came here as warriors, etc., you know, in Spanish America and Latin America, that whole region, and even to Jamaica, the early Maroons, they were not enslaved people.
Right.
They're Africans who came with Columbus to clear the land, etc., and there were Moors from Spain.
Exactly.
I mean, all of that we don't know. We just, you know, we just know that one narrative, you know, and to me, it's knowing the history, because there's so much, it's so powerful when you understand how people survived, and yeah, it's really, really amazing, you know?
Let me ask. I know that in the film you, in part, particularly as the discussion of repatriation, you had several of the African nations that had agreed to open their doors to people of African descent who might want to come and repatriate back there. I know Ghana has done some very progressive kinds of things. In terms of that.
That was a. What happened with the repatriation?
Yeah.
Well, that was a big activity. That was a very big activity, 60s, 70s. I know there are actually a lot of Rastafari and just Pan-Africanists and different, you know, African-Americans and different people who've repatriated to Ghana and Ethiopia. Haile Selassie had given land specifically for people of African descent because people of African descent had supported him in the whole war, you know, to defend Ethiopia against Italian invasion.
Right.
So land had been set aside, but then there were various changes of government in Ethiopia, and the land became... But those people just got legal rights in Ethiopia, like, very recently.
Okay.
I mean, their children were being born in Ethiopia and kind of stateless and all of that, but there's no, you know, I told you... I mean, even the African Union has designated the diaspora as the seventh region of Africa.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of activity around creating structures for repatriation for people who want to return to Africa.
Beautiful.
When those people went to Africa in the 60s, Ghana, Kenya, Ethiopia, I'm not remembering every single one, Kwame Nkrumah, I know they met with Kwame Nkrumah. Yeah, they were all promised, you know, repatriation, but then there was no money, you know what I mean, for people to go back.
Okay.
You're talking about the most marginalized people in Jamaica.
Right.
Someone asked a question, and I just really wanted to say that I know I have 160 hours worth of footage that I shot making this film. This film took me, you know,
how long did it take you to shoot this film?
Yeah, well, the whole process was 10 years of my life. I mean, I made another film in between in Zimbabwe, and I, you know, did other things. But at the same time, it's just a film that I constantly... was always working on over a decade.
So you said
so I have all this footage, and what I'm working on now, besides other projects, is to create a digital archive that will make a lot of the material that I have just kind of public, you know, besides the film. But because I have all the interviews of long interviews of, you know, their missions to Africa, and also, yeah, you know, even people who are not in the film at all, who I interview, who were people who I followed for a while, like Mr. Frank Gordon, he was the head of the UNIA, you know, he was like a Garveyite, and those kind of.
Okay.
So there's a lot of material that I have, you know.
Okay. I've got another caller here.
I'm sorry.
Area code 414-324. Good afternoon, my brother. How you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and good evening to your guest, and it's an outstanding documentary. I enjoyed it tremendously. A lot of good information, and information that that I was not aware of, as it pertains to the Rastafari struggle for repatriation as well as reparation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Is this going to be available for sale soon?
It's always available for sale, but I was going to create a streaming link for pay, and I just said, you know what, let me just give it to the viewers. But, you can buy the DVD online. It's at theprice of memory, the film.com is where you can just go, click there, and you can buy a DVD.
Well, that's
home viewing. Home viewing. I mean, I also have it for universities and such. That's different. But the film is available now in that way. I'm going to put it up for streaming where you can pay to stream it soon. I've had offers, but, you know, it took me a while to figure out which one I wanted to go with. But
what was the mineral? What was the mineral that was found in Jamaica? I can't remember. What was the mineral that was found?
Oh, bauxite.
Bauxite. Bauxite is critical, and that's
aluminum.
That segment of the documentary probably bothered me. I mean, most of it, you know, because I'm a Pan-Africanist. I'm a cultural nationalist. I believe in sovereignty for African people, you know, but when that part of the documentary happened, and still, after all the pleas of the Jamaican people and of African people to Europeans for redress. And then when the bauxite was found, they mined it and just took it and used it and still didn't compensate. Because when the bauxite was found, even though Jamaica is still a commonwealth of Britain, correct?
Mm-hmm. No, but when it was first found, there were a colony. Like, we belonged to them when it was first found.
Okay. And so, therefore, that resource they have control of at that time because of that.
At that time, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot. That's a whole other film. I mean, what happened later in the 70s when Manley tried to, nationalize it and raise the prices and, literally sank Jamaica after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To me, there should be a better coordinated effort through the African Union for dealing with repatriation and reparation for African people, as opposed to doing it country by country or smaller entities by smaller entities. I think that serious coming together of African people to address this, and the arrogance of Caucasians, the arrogance of the British and the French and whoever else, you know, knowing that because I love the way the documentary was done. It laid it out. It laid out clearly that because of this, horror, we are in the condition that we are in today.
Right.
Because of what you have done, and it's very clear, but yet, you know, that's why we have to understand that Europeans suffer from cognitive dissonance. Even though we present the information to them, they ignore it. They dismiss it.
Right.
Because it's not in their DNA to be honest, to be just, to be righteous. It's not in them. And that's why, to me, I think it's a better effort for us as a people to come together collectively, seriously, and make this demand, not just to Europe, but basically to the world, that African people will no longer be mistreated. We're standing up. I know we don't have an army. You know, I know we don't have a defense force, but those things can be developed over time. But we have to make that kind of stance because clearly, Jamaica ain't getting nothing. Barbados ain't getting nothing. African countries ain't getting nothing. Hell, we here in America, we ain't getting nothing either. And that's a fact. Because you can see it clearly over an extended period of time of our petitioning, marching, trying to demonstrating, whatever. And I'm quite sure, you know, we've had some very good lawyers, you know, good counsel, but yet it still constantly falls on deaf ears. Mm-hmm. It's been 50, 30, 40, 50 years, and we've been trying to deal with this. It's constantly delayed, or no, it's denied. It's not delayed, it's denied.
Denied, right, right.
You know, it's denied. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know that Brother West, when he was on earlier, talked about it, you know, 2019 coming up next year, 400 years that we would be in this hemisphere, here in America, in the Caribbean, in South America, in Central America, and our condition today, as bad as it is, almost since our captivity.
Yeah.
And so, to me, the only thing that will change that is African people saying, it is now. We must understand it is now the time that we unite. All the superficial language differences, all of that, kick that to the religion, probably the biggest impediment on the continent and throughout the diaspora is religion, and specifically Christian religion. Because Christian religion speaks to an individual, and the individual is more willing to hide, to hang on to that, as opposed to being, because, you know, it's like, you know, people in Christianity, their attitude is, you know, I'm blessed and highly favored. Oh, really? You're blessed and highly favored? While your community and your people are going to hell, are suffering? But you're blessed and highly favored because you believe in Jesus. Because you believe in Jesus is the Savior and the Son of God. And because that's all you need. So that's because, you know, it puts it on the individual. It's not a religion that will deal with us collectively. And so all of these other impediments, we kick them to the curb. We come together as Jamaicans, as Barbadoans, as Cubans, as American Africans, or all Africans. We're coming together.
I agree.
That's the only way.
Okay, Brother Oshie, thank you so much. We've
got
thank
you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah,
and thank you for the documentary. It is outstanding. I will watch it again. I feel for the brothers and sisters and the effort that have been put forth. But we have to understand what we're dealing with.
Right.
You know?
Thank you.
Okay,
Doctor,
thank you.
Okay. All right, Sister Karen, we got about 4 minutes left. Why don't you kind of wrap it up? Tell us again what you're getting ready to work on. You're working on something else. Kind of explain that for us. And kind of round.
I have several projects in motion. The one that I'm finishing, that which will be released next year. I'm working on a film about a woman in Jamaica who is. She's the paramount chief of the Maroons of Jamaica. Her name is Gama Gloria Sims. Mm-hmm. She is a very extraordinary woman, very charismatic. She's a shaman. She's a traditional healer, but also she's a descendant of the Maroons. And if you may know, the Maroons were the people who ran away during enslavement, and they formed communities, and they had a running war with the British for like 100 years.
Right.
And so it's very different from The Price of Memory, because The Price of Memory is kind of this epic thing about a movement, but this one is about a particular woman. But I think from her story, we get that, you know how you were asking about healing? This is like one family, it's a multi-generational story, really, because it's showing the trauma from through her family, and that leads her to become a healer, a traditional healer, and her embrace of African spirituality in a culture where, although we're pretty much all African people, you know, we've been taught to fear and to be afraid of that part of our culture. So it's a very close look at her life and following her. Mm-hmm. She travels from Jamaica to Suriname, where there are also Maroons in Suriname, where when she goes to Suriname, when she arrives, they're like, whoa, you came with all the ancestors. I mean, this woman is a very powerful spiritual
right.
woman.
Right.
And they gave her this title, which had never been given to a woman before. Men usually get the title of Fugama. Because you're a culture, you're an intercessor to the ancestors, but you're also a political and a cultural leader,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's this one woman's journey,
Well, that's powerful.
That's the film. I mean, you know, I have other films, but that's the main one that should be out next year. I've been working on it for the last 2 years. So I'm very excited about it, you know, just creatively. Okay. And also, I think it's a very powerful story.
Yeah.
And looking forward to that. You can check it out. It's G-A-A-M-A-A. It's on Facebook. Gamma. That's the name of the film.
Fantastic. How long are you going to leave up The Price of Memory? I know you put that up specially for our audience. How long are you going to leave that up?
Okay, yeah, I just created that link for your audience, but right. I can leave it up. Today is what, Tuesday? I can leave it up till Friday if you want.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Just
specific. I mean, that link is literally just for your audience because I haven't put it out there.
Okay, all right.
So you can, I guess the holiday, yeah, Friday, I'll take it down like midnight on Friday.
Okay, sounds
good. Or you know what? I'll take it on Saturday night people have to Saturday to watch it.
Thank you so much. Well, Sister Karen, I really appreciate you. You know, I had been hounding you to get you to come on. I really appreciate you doing that. Last week, we had Brother Eugene Peters, who is the president of the Schomburg. He was on. He knew about your work.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
And so there are folks that they're watching you. They're seeing what you're doing. You know, I know what you're doing.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you're talking about showing the film to your viewers and also making people aware of the work.
Okay.
I think you know, you're doing very valuable work, and I really appreciate you bringing me to this audience,
Thank you very much.
Wishing everybody the very best.
Okay. All right. To our listening audience, take care. I'll see you next week, Tuesday at 8 o'clock. Have a wonderful week and a very productive one. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah.